America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you in the third hour of our program. Music legend Pete Seeger is dropping by. Should be a very interesting conversation. I'm looking forward to it. In our second hour of our program, Thomas Bowden is going to be here from Ayn Rand. Apparently, some communities are banning smoking in connected houses. He thinks we've gone over the top. I think if I had to smell the smoke of the guy next door to me, it's affecting the quality. We'll have a discussion about that. But in our first hour, there's a lot going on in the world, and there's a little bit going on in history, and I'm seeing, feeling, hearing, getting an absolute confluence between and among the two. This week is the 35th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. If you didn't see the movie 13 Days, or if you weren't alive during the time, go out and rent the movie. But this was, we're talking about real weapons of mass destruction. A U-2 pilot went up, took photos, 700 and some odd photos of Cuba, came back, they laid them out, the photo analyst did their thing, and they discovered that not only was Castro getting shipments of all sorts of goodies from the Soviet Union, but that he was getting shipments of missiles. Atomic missiles. And putting them into place. I mean, they were building the silos. They were getting ready. And Kennedy called a group of people together. I think he called it his X-team, as I recall, to ask his advisors, you know, to bring together his advisors and say, you know, what are we going to do about this? How do we stop this? Now, keep in mind the backstory of this. We think Bush is trying to make it like, you know, terrorism is something we've never experienced before. We all need to be scared to death, you know, blah, 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 blah. But this was in 1962. And throughout the 50s, those of us old enough remember growing up with the TV show about Bert the Turtle. Some of you may remember Bert the Turtle. Some of you probably aren't old enough to remember Bert the Turtle. But just, you know, here's a little glimpse into what American children grew up with in the 1950s and 1960s.
Dum dum, little dum dum, little dum dum.
This is a cartoon.
There was a turtle by the name of Bert, and the turtle was very alert. When danger threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do.
And here, whenever danger threatened, he knew just what to do. And here's Bert the Turtle. He's going to, as the flash, now this is a cartoon, and the atomic flash would go off, and you'd see the turtle do his thing.
He's duck and cover, duck and cover.
He did what we all must learn to do.
You and you
and you
and you. Duck and cover.
We must be ready every day, all the time, to do the right thing. The atomic bomb explodes.
And then at that point in this video, they actually went from the cartoon to actually showing a family. It was all in black and white. A family in their backyard, mom, dad wearing his suit, mom wearing her cardigan sweater, and the two little kids, the boy and the girl. And the atomic bomb goes off in the sky, and they grab newspapers and put them over their heads, and they all fall to the ground. I mean, this is what you saw on this advertisement, this, you know, PSA.
Can cover. This family knows what to do, just as your own family should. They know that even a thin cloth helps protect them. Even a newspaper can save you from a bad burn. But the most important thing of all is to duck and cover yourself, especially where your clothes do not cover you.
Remember what to do, friends. Now tell me right out loud.
This is the turtle speaking.
What are you supposed to do when you see the flash? Duck and cover.
So that was the 1950s and 1960s. This is the mentality in America. And by the way, it was being played out like this in the Soviet Union as well. As last night on BBC, they had a fascinating interview with Sergei Khrushchev, the son of Nikita Khrushchev, who said that in the Russian schools, in the Soviet schools, They had the equivalent of duck and cover. I mean, they were all scared to death of us. And so then here we are, the Soviet Union putting missiles into Cuba, nuclear warheads into Cuba, 90 miles off the shore of the United States. And Kennedy said, no, you're not going to do that. It is not going to happen. And here's JFK declaring essentially the beginning of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
Now, the reason I bring this up and why I think it's so important is it's not just the 35th anniversary. What we are hearing right now with this whole Islamo-fascist hysteria, with all the weapons of mass destruction hysteria, with all the bomb Iran now. I mean, yesterday they actually, on one of the TV shows, they actually had a serious discussion with a guy. I found it tragic. It would be hysterical if it wasn't so serious. Discussion about, well, should we bomb now or should we bomb next month? How quickly should we bomb? I guess we should start bombing right away. And we're talking about the lives of people. We're talking about relations between states. And Kennedy sought in all of this to A, get his way, that is, get the nuclear missiles out of Cuba, but B, to avoid war. And was ultimately successful. Even though the Soviets came back with a fairly strong argument, they said, you've got nuclear weapons in Turkey, which is right on our border. Why shouldn't we have nuclear weapons on your border? Nonetheless, Khrushchev and Kennedy worked this thing out, and Kennedy didn't back down. He did achieve a compromise. But here's Kennedy again, this initial news conference where he's announcing this. Notice in particular how he ends it.
Acting, therefore, in the defense of our own security and of the entire Western Hemisphere, and under the authority entrusted to me by the Constitution, as endorsed by the resolution of the Congress.
Now, Congress actually met and gave Kennedy the authority to turn back the Soviet ships, by the way. He went to Congress first.
I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. To halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back.
Now, he was not stopping food, he was not stopping medicine, he wasn't stopping furniture. It was strictly military stuff, and they called it a quarantine and not a blockade.
It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack.
And that was a specific, you know, you could come after any nation in the Western Hemisphere. You've come after us.
By the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union. I call upon Chairman Khrushchev.
Now, he has just threatened the big stick. And he follows through with the honest and with an extraordinary sense of integrity, as you'll hear in just a few minutes, the call of a statesman.
To halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace and the stable relations between our two nations. I call upon him further to abandon this course of world domination and to join in an historic effort to end the perilous arms race and to transform the history of man. Our goal is not the victory of might, but the vindication of right. Not peace at the expense of freedom, but both peace and freedom here in this hemisphere, and we hope around the world. God willing, that goal will be achieved.
Now, God willing, that goal will be achieved. And essentially, Kennedy talking about peace and in fact, saying we're interested in ending the arms race. We're actually willing to reduce our weapons, which is ultimately, you know, some of the treaties that we entered into, saying we're willing to back away from this if you'll back away from this. Let's all step back from this precipice. Rather than this, he's evil. Can you imagine if Kennedy had gone on TV and said, that Khrushchev, he's a godless communist, he's evil. He's part of the Axis of Evil. we might not even be here now. If today's Republicans had been in office in 1962, we might not even be here now. Just a few more thoughts from Jack Kennedy about peace to wrap this up and put it in the context of today and what we've so lost and what we need to recapture of the American spirit right after this, 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Well, and it nearly was. I mean, it nearly was, and thank God John Kennedy was our president at the time. Quite literally. Thank God. 21 minutes past the hour. And just consider this. As Brundlefly over at the Daily Kos pointed out, or Democratic Underground, rather, pointed out this morning, after Bush asked for an additional $42 billion for war making, it took 25 minutes before the administration released a new Obama audio tape. Brundle points out it's not even subtle anymore. It's not even subtle. You know, give us more money for war. Give us more money for our buddies. Give us more money for our cronies. Oh, by the way, Osama. Come on. We have already spent, according to the National Priorities Project, although some $800 billion has been appropriated and well over $1 trillion will be spent, we have already spent cash dollars of $462,372,925,000 in Iraq. Just that cost could have hired 8,012,000 public school teachers for a full year, full salary benefits, the whole thing. 8 million new teachers. Now, these were the priorities back when Jack Kennedy was president and the top tax rate, the top marginal tax rate on people who earned more than $3.2 million in today's dollars was 71%. Before that, when Dwight Eisenhower was president, the top marginal tax rate was 91%. I'm telling you, we need to roll back the Reagan tax cuts as step one. Those were our priorities. We were building our bridges. We were building our schools. We were building our infrastructure. And it's lasted 50 years. I said 35th anniversary. It's the 45th anniversary. I apologize, and thank you for the folks who called in to correct us. This week is the 45th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. 9-10 months later, in June of 63, John Kennedy was still speaking of peace. He was still talking about the importance of it. He said, there is no more a vital issue for our time than peace. It is the most important thing. And the kind of peace he said that he was talking about was not the peace of the grave, but an active process. As he pointed out, it's not always the sexiest thing to talk about. It's not even the thing that gets you power, but it's the most important.
I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war. And frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears. But we have no more urgent task.
We have no more urgent task. And then talking about, you know, should we bomb innocent civilians because we don't like their government?
No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue.
No, but we'll slap sanctions on Iraq and kill 500,000 Iraqi children and then go in and bomb them and kill 1 million. And now they're talking about bombing Iraq, and now they're talking about bombing Iran. Kennedy wrapped up this speech. This is from June 10th, 1963 at Michigan State University.
The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war. We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression. We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
A strategy of peace. An active thing. And here now, Bush, the Republicans, basically, I mean, we need to stop saying this is Bush's war, et cetera. This is the Republican war. This is the entire Republican Party is gung-ho on this thing. The Republicans are coming forward asking for $46 billion more in war funding. This now, this is interesting. The Washington Post headline, and this was over at tip of the hat to Kangaroo X over at Daily Kos. The New York Times said it right. Bush, the headline, Bush's request for wars increases to $196 billion. That's for this year, this fiscal year, October to October. Bush's request for wars increases to $196 billion. That's enough to hire, what, about 2 million public school teachers nationwide? The Washington Post sought to minimize that. I don't know, maybe they're trying to make friends with the Bush administration. They said simply Bush asked Congress for $46 billion more in war funding. But this is the largest annual hit for the occupation of Iraq and military since 9/11. And, well, since before that, for that matter. It would bring the total appropriated to more than $800 billion. It could reach $1 trillion by the time Bush leaves office, as the New York Times pointed out. There's a couple of good things in here. You know, $100 million for reconstruction, $125 million for free. All of it adds up to less than 1% of what's going on. 27 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour. In a scientific paper published a year ago, this is by Don Shapley, the news editor at the Daily Green. In a scientific paper published a year ago, co-authored by Tim Sweatman at the University of Arizona's Laboratory of Tree Ring Research and Anthony Westerling of the University of California, San Diego's Scripps Institution of Oceanography, scientists concluded that the changing climate was a greater influence on wildfire activity and intensity than forest management. We learn this now as California's on blaze. There were four times as many major wildfires between 1986 and 2004 as between 1970 and 1986, and a six-fold increase in the area of forest burned in the western United States. The active wildfire season has increased by more than 2 months. As spring and summer temperature has increased, snowpacks in the mountains have melted earlier, between 1 week and 1 month earlier on average than 50 years ago. Since snowmelt is responsible for 75% of annual stream flow, the decrease in snowpack drain drains regional streams and rivers, leading to a drop in humidity and thus, therefore, less rain and more dryness and more fires. So while no one event can be attributed to climate change, I think it is safe to say that what we are seeing in Southern California right now is just the beginning. Not necessarily of what's going to go on in California, but just the beginning of what we're going to see all around the world. And we are seeing all over the world as deserts are encroaching on areas that were not desert and haven't been desert for tens of thousands of years and so on. Just one other quick news story, and then we'll pick up your phone calls here. Poland had an election on Sunday, and the conservatives who have been ruling Poland for 2 years, who have been good buddies with the Bush administration, got thrown out on their butts. And as a consequence of this, a lot of people are speculating, inside Poland, a lot of people are speculating that Poland may revisit its decision to allow Bush to put his missiles there. Bush wants to put missiles in Poland and Czechoslovakia. This is what has got Vladimir Putin absolutely freaking out. Pulling out of treaties, threatening a new generation of nuclear weapons, threatening the United States and the rest of Europe by implication. And Robert Gates today says, well, maybe we're going to delay activating our missile sites in Europe. Yeah. This is the administration's way of saving face, I'm telling you, because Poland is saying, no, we don't want to go along with this. The new government in Poland will be saying that. We're not going to go along. We're not going to play with this. In the meantime, Bush is asking for a whole pile. He's asking for billions and billions of dollars, and buried in it is a few million here and there. Keep in mind, a million is a thousandth of a billion. There's a few million dollars here and there for what might arguably be good things. $160 million for construction of residential housing. $100 million, excuse me, to prepare the country for the 2009 elections. $115 million for power generators in Kabul. Well, who's going to be opposed to that? Well, I am if it's attached to a $40-plus billion supplemental that is going to maintain the occupation and get more of our soldiers killed and get more Iraqis killed and maintain our irritating presence in that part of the world. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado, listening on KKZN. Hey, Ralph, what's on your mind today?
Tom, I was in the Air Force during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I don't think civilians yet understand how close we came. There's a wonderful and terrible quote from Erasmus in the Middle Ages, and that is that war is delightful to those who have no experience of it.
Yeah.
Kennedy had the good sense and the battle experience to understand that war is absolutely the last alternative.
No, so, Kennedy was sitting in the White House with his back hurting so much he could hardly stand up straight because his boat, PT-109, had gotten blown out of the water. And even at that, 3 days in a row, he swam out at night looking for his soldiers and looking for ships that might pick them up. I mean, the guy, you go back and look at what he did during World War II, he was a real hero, and he actually did know the horrors of war.
Absolutely. And on the other side, you had Khrushchev, who was battle commissar for Stalingrad.
That's right. He had seen many people die.
Yeah, they didn't have to prove their manhood like Bush does. Both of them knew war. They knew the horrors of war, and they both compromised.
Yeah, and it's not just Bush. It's the whole Republican choir. You get all these chicken hawks. I mean, you know, John McCain makes the point he's the only guy up on the stage who's not a chicken hawk, and he's opposed to torture, and they're all thumping their chests about who's going to have more Abu Ghraibs or more, Guantanamo Bays. And now your point is very, very well taken, Ralph, and very well said.
May I add one more quote?
You may.
This is from Machiavelli, and I'm not quite exactly right on this, but what he said was, a ruler can start a war whenever he chooses, but he cannot control it or decide when that war ends.
Yeah.
Think about Iraq and Bush already. We know that.
Yeah.
And we're about to do it again.
I know.
Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome. Very well said, Ralph. And we really should take the ex-senator from Vermont's advice and just declare victory and come home. Nancy in Iowa. Hey, Nancy, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much. I have to stream you to get you, but it's worth it. For my money, you've got the best show anywhere, and
I read all
your books, and you just have so much information, and I want to thank you so much for playing that quote from John Kennedy. It makes me cry every time. Where are the statesmen today? Where are they?
I think there are a few. I think Russ Feingold is one of the greatest statesmen that we have, for example.
And I always enjoy Bernie on Fridays, but they don't seem to have any power. But I would just want to thank you for being there.
You're welcome, Nancy, and thank you for the call and for your kind words. Thomas Jefferson was confronted with this during the, I think it was the 1798 or 1799. It was right after the Alien and Sedition Acts were passed, and John Adams was president. Jefferson was vice president, simply because he got the second largest number of votes. They were not friends or allies. They were political enemies at that point. And Jefferson was watching newspaper editors being put in prison. Adams had put over 20 of them in prison, shut down their newspapers. He threw into jail Matthew Lyon, the congressman from Vermont, for standing up on the floor of the House of Representatives and saying that Roger Griswold, the congressman from Connecticut, represented the interests of big money and didn't give a damn about the average person. And Griswold came after him with a cane. And under the Alien Sedition Acts, John Adams went nuts. He became a dictator. And Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter to a friend of his, and he said, and I'm paraphrasing this terribly from memory, I'm sure. I wrote an op-ed piece about it a couple of years ago, but it's been a while since I read the quote. But basically he said, and a little time and a little time, and the reign of witches will pass. I mean, we have seen this before, and I'm telling you, the reign of witches will pass. This too shall pass. Terry in Jackson, excuse me, Weldon in British Columbia, Canada. Hey, Weldon.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for everything that you do. Really appreciate it. Excuse me. I just wanted to make the comment and also ask a quick question. I'm sure you're familiar with Noam Chomsky's book, and his contention was that basically the Cuban Missile Crisis came out of the direct result of Kennedy proliferating nuclear bombs in Turkey and parking them on the Russia's border.
Yeah, that's one theory, and in fact, toward the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Khrushchev was saying, "Okay, take your missiles out of Turkey, and you know everything will be hunky dory." I think, frankly, though, that if you more closely look at history, and I don't want to get in a fight with Noam Chomsky about this, but I did co-author a book on the history of Cuba and the Kennedys' relationship with it, that the real thing that prompted Castro and Khrushchev to get together and say, "Let's put these missiles in Cuba," was the Bay of Pigs. Which, by the way, was conceived by Richard Nixon as an October surprise. It was supposed to happen in October of 1960 when Nixon was running against Kennedy in the election. In late 59, Eisenhower had a severe heart attack. He was largely disabled. And Cuba had just gone communist. And on Nixon's watch, Nixon completely blew it because Castro originally wanted to be our ally. And so he became the Soviet Union's ally. And Kennedy was beating the bejesus out of him in the election over this issue, and Nixon saw it coming in 59. He was put in charge of the Cuba Committee, I forget the exact title for it, in the Eisenhower administration. He was vice president at the time, and he planned this invasion of Cuba for the fall, for October of 1960, during the election, just, you know, a month before the election, figuring that the invasion would make him look so strong and would take away the club that Kennedy was using to beat him up, which was that he had allowed Cuba to go communist. The weather was bad. There were a number of things that caused it not to happen. The weather was the main one. And so it didn't happen. And so Kennedy inherited this ongoing operation that he didn't even know about when he came into the White House. He allowed it to happen, which was a mistake.
Yeah.
It was a disaster, which was a mistake. And the result of that, frankly, I think is what led to Castro and Khrushchev getting together and saying, let's put nuclear missiles here.
Well, Chomsky also contends that it was Russian sub commander that actually said no to the order to fire.
That Khrushchev had actually given an order to fire?
Yeah.
And the
sub commander is actually, you know, because they're always painting Soviet Russia as, you know, as the bad guy, but it was actually the sub commander that defied an order and would not release his nukes.
Yeah. Well, again, I don't, you know, Noam Chomsky isn't here to defend himself or put fine nuance on it, and I'm not familiar with that theory of it, but whatever it may be, the bottom line is that John Kennedy was talking about peace, he was talking about pulling us together, he was talking about the importance of having a world at peace and what a great thing that would be. And he worked for that, and he spoke about that almost as frequently as Dennis Kucinich. And I just think it's so strange that today, when Dennis Kucinich talks about a Department of Peace and talks about the importance of peace, people go, oh, what is he, some kind of wimp? And when John Kennedy talked about it, or when Dwight Eisenhower in 1952, his campaign slogan was, vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower, Americans thought, that's pretty patriotic.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Was right and not political code. Where leaders in D.C. still respected you and me. The America my daddy taught to me. Terry Schiavo was exploited. Katrina was ignored. We saw church and state out on a date behind closed doors. Torture prisoners tap our phones while selling family values here at America, my daddy used to know.
Yeah, we all do.
Right, and not
9 minutes before the hour. Hey, a varmint alert. Hey, varmint alert. As you know, we are broadcasting live from the banks of the Willamette River here in Portland, Oregon, a river that feeds into the Columbia, which feeds out to the Pacific, the second largest river in North America. And Louise and I live on a floating house in the river. And in fact, I opened my book, Cracking the Code, with the story of Guccellini, this crazed goose who was living on our back dock. And boy, is it, whenever the seasons change, it is so amazing. We've been living here 2.5 years. And you see, I mean, for example, part of the year, the ducks are, the males and females are all together. Part of the year, they separate themselves into groups. We actually had, by the way, let me just toss this in. And then there's the duck rutting season, I guess would be the legal way to say it on the radio, where they all get kind of wild and crazy out in the water. We actually had for 2 years, we've had a gay duck couple, two male ducks who are a pair, and they have been living out behind our house for 2 years now, in the little forest preserve, nature preserve back there. So it's amazing. But now there's a sea otter that has taken up residence under one of our neighbors' houses. They called the wildlife people and said, how do we get rid of it? They said, you can't get rid of it. The sea otters were here before you were, and this one has a family. We've got somebody saw a mink on the deck 2 days ago, one of our neighbors. And every morning, you know, we walk out and there's the beavers going back and forth, which makes you a little nervous when you live in a wooden house out in the water. Anyhow, our varmint alert for the day. It's just amazing. It's just amazing. I absolutely love living out in the woods. And speaking of Portland, Andrew in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Andrew, what's up?
Hi, I was wondering if we could pay for the war by ensuring that all the companies that are making more than 10% of the profit aren't allowed to do that, or we tax that at a really high rate. And, you know, that's pretty easy to do. It's pretty easy to track. There's a lot of GSA contracts that are approved and auditing that we're not really doing that we could easily do.
Yeah, although one of the problems that they're having right now, one of the contracts in Iraq for over $1 billion, it's in today's paper, that they're unable to find pretty much any information on it at all. But Andrew, I agree with the gist of your point that we need to say war profiteering, no. Franklin Roosevelt said, I do not want one millionaire made as a result of this war, World War II. Not one. And Harry Truman, who was a senator at the time and was going after war profiteers, he started the Truman Commission, which is something that you would think the president wouldn't like, right? He says, you know, has anybody got any influence from FDR, from the president, and things like that? I mean, he went after them. And Franklin Roosevelt was so impressed by that he offered Harry Truman the job of his being vice president for his fourth term. So it's not an insignificant thing, not at all an insignificant thing. Max in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Max, welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning. Earlier something was said about George Bush and manhood, and most recently the outrage. I want to speak of the outrage, those people outraged by Congressmember Stark's remarks. And unfortunately, Nancy Pelosi chose to rebuke the congressman. Although what he said concerning the war was true, the so-called rude part, and while it does come off rude, but it can be illustrated otherwise, was when he spoke about the president's
for his
amusement.
Right.
Well, Ms. Pelosi needs new riders because she could have taken him to task for that, but also pointing out the president's famous slideshow at the correspondence dinner.
Right. No weapons of mass destruction under my desk, under the table here. Yeah, and everybody was laughing hysterically.
And there was an insurgency going on at that point. Yeah. Even if one is once again giving the benefit of the doubt to the president, it was mistaken intelligence. There were no lies. This man of honor does not lie. Even taking all that into question, he was making light of some serious stuff.
Yeah. Well, not only that, Max.
He got away with it as always.
Yeah, of course. And if you look at the pictures of him on the aircraft carrier on the USS Abraham Lincoln, it's like, oh, I'm a rock star. You know, strutting around in his. I
I don't disagree. Frankly, I have to say I don't disagree with Pete Stark. I'll just leave it at that. Terry in Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Terry.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Listen,
when I was in college, I wrote a paper on the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I uncovered in my research is that one of the driving factors in the peaceful resolution of that conflict is that Khrushchev and Kennedy eventually came to realize that while the United States and the Soviet Union were threats to each other, the greater threats were nuclear annihilation. They
That's
knew
right.
the consequences of their actions. And I
That's
just
right.
don't think the president understands the consequences of his actions.
Well, he's got a bunch of people surrounding him saying you can do it without consequences. Look at Israel just hit a site in Syria, and there's been no blowback from that. We can do the same thing in Iran. And so, you know, I'm very concerned that, and you got Bill Kristol on TV and all these other chicken hawks out there going, oh, yeah, we can hit them out. There'll be no consequences. There'll be no downside to it. And I think it's absolute insanity. Just plain old flat out insanity. Coming up next, should you be allowed to smoke in your own house if your house is attached to somebody else's house and they end up smelling your smoke? Well, some communities think not. Ayn Rand thinks yes.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
And welcome back. Our quote for the day from Oliver Wendell Holmes. The right to swing my fist ends where the other man's nose begins. How messy should we allow democracy to be? At what point, if it's the will of the majority in a democracy, do we say, okay, we're going to do that? Belmont, California recently passed a statute banning smoking in apartments and multi-unit dwellings. Arguably, reading the article here from the San Francisco Times or sfgate.com, I'm not sure it actually would be owned properties, but apartment residents whose secondhand smoke, this is a quote from the sfgate.com, apartment residents whose secondhand smoke invades their neighbors' units will be subject to fines of as much as $1,000. If I'm living, and I'm so allergic to cigarette smoke that if I get even a relatively small amount of it for the next 24 hours, I have a sore throat and a plugged up nose. If I'm living next door to them, I think it's a fine thing that they get a fine for smoking next door to me. Thomas Bowden, however, disagrees. He's an analyst focusing on legal issues for the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND, the holders of the flame of Ayn Rand, the author of Atlas Shrugged and Fountainhead and many essays on objectivism, the author of the creator of the idea of objectivism, which animates and informs modern libertarian thinking and modern conservative thinking, although consider yourself far more pure than all those guys who have diluted all this stuff down, right? I hope I'm not mischaracterizing it.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Thomas. Welcome to the program. So if a community of people gets together and elects to pass a law to protect people from cigarette smoke who are irritated by it, what's wrong with that?
Well, what we've got to look at is upholding the principle of property rights. Property rights are a good thing because they protect everybody's freedom of action, protect smokers and non-smokers.
I absolutely respect your right. Let's say you and I have apartments next to each other. I would respect your right to use any drugs you want in your apartment. I got no problem. You want to shoot heroin, you want to snort cocaine, whatever. If it was legal, frankly, I support the decriminalization of all drugs, but as I suspect you do as well. But nonetheless, I say, you know, you want to drink alcohol, you want to snort tobacco, you want to chew tobacco.
Well,
I got no problem. But when you start putting something into the air that we share, you have stepped over the property and you are now talking about the commons.
Well, here's the thing. You got to step back. The real property rights in an apartment house are, in the owner of the apartment house. The property rights in a restaurant are in the owner of the property, owner of the restaurant, not in the patrons. So you have to, when you go on somebody else's property, you consent to play by their rules. If smokers want to get together and a restaurant owner can make money from smokers, then he should be free to allow smoking on that property. But if non-smokers want to get together and eat without smoke, and I hate smoke, I can't stand to eat around smoke, then you take your business to a restaurant that has a non-smoking section or doesn't allow smoking at all.
In a very prosperous world where everybody could easily and freely make any choices that they want about where they're going to work and whether they're going to work in a place where there's smoke or not, you know, I might be inclined to agree with you. A friend of mine, Tom Larson, started the first major white table linen tablecloth restaurant, the Pillar House in Boston, back in 1980, I think it was, or 81, that was entirely non-smoking. It was a big deal, big freak out in Boston at the time. He actually saw his business go up and became more profitable as a consequence of it. You know, it does work, but at the same time, you know, I have worked, and my wife has worked, and friends of ours worked, you know, back when we were working our way through college and whatnot, in bars or in restaurants where we had to put up with secondhand smoke, and I just don't think that that's fair or that's right. When there's a shortage of jobs, and that's what you take.
You have to keep your eye on the ball. The principle of property rights has to be upheld as a principle. If you don't, then all of your property rights are up for majority vote at any point.
But how does my property, you're suggesting...
Tom Hartman does not want what he does with his microphone or with his car or in his business or with his books to be up for majority vote. You can't have...
It's fine with me if I attach my microphone to a loudspeaker that is so loud that the guy in the apartment next to me or the house that's attached to my house, or for that matter, the house that's not even attached to my house, can hear everything I say and he objects to that. I have no problem with his objecting to that and causing me to turn my volume down.
I'm with you.
And we're really
that.
Talking about the same thing here.
If
you're with me on that, then if you don't like
neighbors.
Noise pollution, why do you like smoke pollution?
Well, if you got two neighbors and one is blowing smoke on the other's patio to the point where the person on his patio cannot eat, then that's a nuisance and that ought to be prevented. What we're talking about here is the ability for people on their own property to do things that are confined on their own property.
I would submit to you that anything that goes into the air, which is our commons, is not on your own property. Let's just take this out a little bit, because I think we've both made our points on this and done it well. In Maine, in Portland, Maine, we have a school board that voted 7-2 in favor in the 64,000 person city, the largest city in Maine, voted 7-2 in favor of allowing the public health officials in the school nurse essentially, to dispense birth control pills to girls 11 to 13. Now, they've been dispensing condoms for years. Nobody has raised a stink about it. That was going to boys. But now, all of a sudden, birth control for girls, people are freaking out. Again, this was the result of democracy, in my opinion. There was a vote. They voted 7-2 in favor of it. If the local community doesn't like it, they can throw these bums out. They, you know, as the phrase goes, they can call another election. And in fact, apparently there's an effort to do so, a recall. What's your take on this?
Well, you know, I know you're a proponent of democracy, but I don't think people's individual rights should be up for a majority vote. I think that's much more dangerous than what you fear, which is a kind of corporate dominance where you think corporations are going to control the world. The fact
so you're not in favor of democracy?
Pardon me?
You're not in favor of democracy.
I'm not in favor of an absolute democracy that allows, you know, you to vote that Socrates has to be executed.
Well, Socrates actually, you know, was an advocate of two different attempts to overthrow the Greek government. I mean,
I'm not in favor
read E.F. Stone's biography.
Override individual rights. You need a constitutional republic like we used to have, like we still should have, that allows majority votes on matters of detail that don't override the rights of the individual. Otherwise, slavery could be legal. I mean,
well, I agree with you on that. If we want to split hairs, we live in a constitutionally limited democratic republic.
Limited by what? That's the key thing that people don't think about. It's limited by the individual.
The power of government is limited by the Constitution, not the power
limited,
of you and me.
Limited according to what principle? Limited how? What I say is limited to protecting the individual rights of the citizens and not infringing on those rights. That's the
But that's not what the Constitution says. The preamble of the Constitution says that it was created to create a more perfect union, which has to do with community, establish justice, which I think has to do with community, ensure domestic tranquility, which has to do with not the individual but the community, provide for the common defense, which is the community, promote the general welfare, which is the community, and ensure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity.
And don't infringe on the life, liberty, or property of the citizens without due process of law. That's
no, you won't find that phrase in there. In fact, Jefferson took life, liberty, and property from John Locke and changed it to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence.
That's in the Declaration of Independence. That's not the law. I'm talking about the Constitution.
Right.
Fifth Amendment, 14th Amendment. Government can't deprive a citizen of life, liberty, or property without due process of law.
Oh, without due process of law.
Yes.
But see, due process of law comes about as a consequence of a majority vote.
Well, no, that's the whole point.
Sure it does. If our elected representatives vote to pass a law, that now is due process of law.
Your rights are not a gift of society. Society has to recognize them. That's why government is created, is to protect your rights. They're not a
So we just have a few seconds left, Thomas. A confluence between the birth control thing and the tobacco thing. Do you see a connection here? I do. And in it, what I see is that both are the results of democratic processes.
The fundamental thing that you can say about the school board situation is that education should be a private enterprise, and each parent should have the right to send his or her child to a school where.
So we shouldn't even have public schools.
Pardon me?
We shouldn't even have public schools.
No, of course not.
Because that's
what's more important. People say education is so important. What's more important than eating? We don't have to have a public bureau of restaurants to have restaurants for everybody. People
well, we do have a public bureau of restaurants being safe.
I'm talking about
you would be opposed to that too, though,
there's
right?
Plenty
the
of
USDA
stores and plenty of restaurants to provide the most basic function of eating without the government to say it has to happen. Education should be private.
Okay. Well, an interesting conversation. Thomas Bowden, he's with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Thomas, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Democracy? Messy? As Don Rumsfeld would say?
The Tom Hartman program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Cause I got the secondhand smoking blues. Yeah, I got the secondhand smoking blues.
Speaking as a former smoker myself, I smoked from the time I was around, I don't know, 14 or so until I was, 22, I think, was when Louise got pregnant with our oldest. And we both smoked at the time. We both smoked since we were teenagers, and we both quit and haven't smoked since. But speaking as a former smoker, I'll tell you, it's just another drug addiction. We know that nicotine is about five times more addictive than heroin. It is the most addictive drug known to the human race. And the tobacco companies, since the 1950s, have added ammonia to tobacco in order to make it more alkaline. They're freebasing the nicotine in it so that when people inhale it, they get an instant hit. Wham! As an alkaline substance, it combines very instantly with some of the acids in the bloodstream and gets quickly transported across the blood-brain barrier into the brain to produce the... So why don't the tobacco companies just, get honest about it? Yeah, it takes too long to chew the stuff, and it takes too long to swallow a pill or the gum. Why don't they just start producing little syringes preloaded with a nicotine, and you can just roll up your sleeve and, you can get that bang the same way that you do by smoking the free-based version that we call cigarettes. And then you don't have to spray it in my face. Unless somebody decides to be a wise guy and starts squirting their syringe around. I mean, that I suppose you could call assault. Why could you call that assault and you don't call blowing smoke on somebody assault? Democracy is messy. Sometimes people get together and they say, within the limits of the law, there are things that we can choose to do as a community or choose not to do as a community. And what we're choosing to do as a community is to say, no, we're not going to allow people to smoke in attached buildings. Because it's inevitably going to end up in somebody else's lungs. This has got nothing to do with trying to control whether or not people smoke or take nicotine or take that as a particular drug. They could take that drug all day long. There's 100 different ways to take that drug. Well, at least 3 big ways to take that drug. And lighting and inhaling and blowing it back out into the air is only one of them. Similarly, we've got this school board in Maine that voted 7-2 in favor of adding prescription contraceptives to the services offered at the health clinic, to quote Katie Zazima in the New York Times. Some of the people on the school board are backing off a little bit on this. But here's the bottom line. In the last 4 years, 7 of the students, of the middle school students in this school, have become pregnant. 7 of them just in the last school year. So sometimes when you have a problem and you have a limited toolkit, you do what you can with the tools you have. The school board can't parent these kids. Some would argue that the parents aren't doing a particularly good job. The school board can't control the culture, the television, the advertising that these kids are exposed to, the movies they see, the videos that they see, the music that they listen to, which some would argue is encouraging promiscuity. The school board can't control the fact that in many communities, the middle class is breaking down as a consequence of 26 years of a conservative war on the middle class. And as a consequence of that, parents aren't home anywhere near as much as they used to be and can't spend as much time with their kids because they're simply working so hard trying to survive. School board can't control any of those things. But they do have this health program. And for years and years and years, they've been passing out everything from aspirin to condoms. And when you've got a small school and 17 kids get pregnant in 4 years, 7 of them in the last year, you say, okay, we can't do anything about the other variables, but we can possibly do something about this variable. Of the 500 students at King Middle School, 135 have asked permission to use the clinic. Of those 5 students, all of whom were either 14 or 15 years old, reported being sexually active in the last school year. 1 became pregnant. Parents have to sign a waiver before their kids can participate in this program, so it's not like they don't know what's going on. And what the school district is thinking about now is breaking it basically into 2 programs that both require warrants, waivers from the parents. Will you allow your child to participate in the health program that gets them health and dental screening and other things that you would say, oh, well, you know, families should provide for that. Yeah, but except the families can't even afford to pay for health insurance. How are they going to pay for, you know, a $1,000 dental bill? Or how are they going to pay for, you know, $100 physical? You can't. They don't have the money. So, number 1. Kitty Purdington, this is from the New York Times article, whose daughter attends King, says she has mixed feelings about the decision to provide contraceptives to middle school students, but thought it was the right decision. She said, it brings home the fact that my 13-year-old daughter has friends and people around her who are sexually active, but at least it's a good alternative in a not-so-good situation. No one's going to stand up and cheer the 12, 13, 14-year-olds are having sex, but it's not anything new. You know, speaking as the parent of 3 children, 2 girls and a boy, Louise and I, you know, are the parents of 3 kids who all at one point or another in their lives were 13, 14, 15 years old. I'd say if I was on this school board, this would be a really tough call, but I would probably go the same way that they did. You've got a real problem, and the school board has a very limited set of tools. But again, it's how messy are we going to let democracy be? There are some folks who don't want democracy to be at all messy. Oh, no, 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 no. We can't have the will of the people prevailing. It's got to be the will of Jerry Falwell. I mean, after all, he's the guy who's got to make up the rules, you know.
Killing stops, and I'm for the president. Chase them all over the world. If it takes 10 years, blow them all away in the name of the Lord.
Yeah, that's how it should be done, even if they want to smoke or have sex. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
So how messy are we going to let democracy become here in the United States of America? To what extent do we allow local communities to make local decisions? Or are we going to have, you know, the national bloviators? I guess I fall into that category. Are we going to have national politicians making decisions? You know, Bill Frist and Terry Schiavo, for example. I mean, at what point do we say, okay, this is a local issue, this is how the local community voted, that's their community, they get to live with it. Chris in Leonia, New Jersey, is that right, Chris?
Yeah, I'm from New Jersey.
What's up?
All right, this is the thing, Tom. I want to know why you think that it is okay to outlaw things in the public sector, which can easily be abrogated in other directions. I mean, vegetarians don't go into steakhouses. Why not have apartment buildings which are smoking or non-smoking as they have in hotels?
It's an imperfect analogy, Chris. First of all, as a vegetarian, I often go into steakhouses because it's very often where you'll find the very best salad bars. And nobody has ever come up and thrown a steak in my face.
Well, I understand that. And as a smoker and someone who would like to quit smoking, I've had a hard time with it. I understand that it is not that is offensive to other people, and I try to keep it inoffensive as best as I can, especially the place that I work. My boss just had heart surgery. He has a hard time breathing.
So it's more than just offensive, you know. And by the way, good on you for being respectful about it. I tell you, when I was a smoker, I had an attitude about it, but that was, you know, 30 years ago, and I guess there was times have changed.
Well, I had a bad attitude about it for a long time because I considered it to be my right. And now, as someone more mature, I have to say that as someone who's in favor of decriminalizing drugs, who's in favor of as much freedom as possible, I don't eat sweetbreads because they're brains. I find it disgusting. Yes, no one's sticking in my face, but I'm not going to persecute somebody else for eating them. And
but see, that's the difference, is the aerosolizing of things. I mean, it's again, I wouldn't want somebody smoking pot in the apartment next to me unless it was something that I wanted to be inhaling, frankly. If they shoot up the stuff, or if they snort it, or if they drink it, or if they put it in brownies, I don't care. But if somebody is aerosolizing it, burning it, putting it into the air, and then in an environment where I'm forced to breathe it, I got a problem with that. I think it's a legitimate problem.
Well, I would argue that somebody shooting up in the apartment next to you is probably more deleterious to your health than somebody smoking. But
not if it's legal.
Well, who knows what somebody who's shooting.
There are diabetics all over this country who shoot up every day. They're shooting up insulin. I don't think that's a public health problem. There's probably millions of them.
I mean, shooting up insulin is a little different than shooting up heroin. Wouldn't you agree that someone who shoots heroin is going to be more dangerous to the population?
As long as it's illegal. When England decriminalized heroin, petty crime dropped by about a third. There was a massive drop in crime. And what they found, there was a great BBC special on this about 10 years ago. And what they found was that there were stockbrokers and lawyers and doctors, you know, oddly enough. And, I mean, professionals, school teachers, janitors. I mean, right across the way, it just cut across all social boundaries, who were heroin addicts, who were able to manage their addiction once they decriminalized it and were no longer criminals. They became part of society.
Tom, I agree with you entirely about the decriminalization of it. I believe that it being criminalized is what causes most of the problem. But if you're talking about responsibility, if I go into a non-smoking restaurant, I don't smoke in that restaurant.
Yeah, well, that's my point, Chris. I got to move along, but thanks for your call and you know, thoughtful and. And Nick in Cliffside Park, New Jersey, another New Jersey call. Hey, Nick.
Hey, Tom. In my opinion, Ayn Rand would be spinning in her grave if she heard the previous segment, and I'll tell you why.
Well, she was a smoker.
Well, aside from that, a property rights has to include my property. In my condo, if some of the next door is emitting a toxic gas, which is carcinogenic, and it comes into my breathing space, that person is polluting my property. My property rights are being violated, not that person's.
Right,
that's
my point. That's why
upside down.
Right, that's why our quote for the day is from Oliver Wendell Holmes, the right to swing my fist ends where the other person's nose begins.
And to take a step further, the ultimate property right is the property of your own body. If someone is doing something which is causing your body harm, you have an obligation, even beyond the law, to make that stop and make it go away. I'm allergic to cigarettes, too. And if I'm being made sick by something, I'll do whatever it takes, short of you know, really extreme violence necessarily, but, you know, you're well within your rights to make that person stop smoking. If you have to, you leave the area. But this is an outrage that I think that guy allowed his prejudice in favor of smokers to influence his own political judgment. That's not.
Well, I think your point, Cliff, that the ultimate property is your personal property, your own body, is the one that should probably trump everything. But well said. Thank you very much. Tim in New York City. Hey, Tim.
Hi, yes. I actually own a bar that was affected drastically by the smoking ban. And while I enjoy the environment that I'm in now, better, I still think that it's unfair for the city and the state to have made a law that affected how I decided to run my business.
But, you know, there's a whole variety of laws. You can't sell things that are infected with salmonella in your bar either. Do you feel like your freedom has been infringed on because another unhealthy product is not available in your bar?
No, absolutely not. But I did buy into an existing bar that had an existing revenue stream. And I took out a loan to do so before the smoking ban, before there was talk about it. I made the decision to go into this business based on what my loan payments would be versus what I would be making. And all of a sudden, after I'm committed to that, the rules changed, and I didn't feel like that was.
But the smoking ban hit every bar in New York City. It's not like all of a sudden the smokers decided to go down to Ralph's bar down the street. I mean, there was no bar that they could smoke in, and so so you're suggesting that a lot of people only came to the bar because they could smoke there?
No. Yes. I think our bar, not serving food, and the type of bar it was, had a lot of smokers in it. But I disagree. I think that there were bars that were not complying with the law. There are a few bars that you can smoke legally in. I'm sure their business went up. I know there were bars that were not complying with the law whose business went up. And I happen to be close.
That's not fair.
What's not
fair? Good on you, Tim, for following the law. And again, in any time when in an institution, you know, a democratic institution like a city or a community or a county or whatever decides that they're going to change the rules of the game with the consent of the majority of the community through the small d democratic process, you know, it's going to affect some people adversely. I mean, it's just the way it is. So, you know, I sympathize with you, but and I wish you well in your business. But
I smoked for years and years. I enjoy the environment now in the bar without it. But if I had the choice, I would go back to a smoking bar. Now, as time's gone on, I don't know that would affect the business as positively as it would have in the first couple of years, but I know.
I doubt it would at all, because there are a lot of people like me who for a lot of years didn't go into bars because the cigarette smoke was so bad. And you're finding that I would guess that there's probably been a balancing effect. I think we've seen it in a lot of cities where people who just stayed away from bars because of the cigarette smoke are coming back into them. But who knows how it all balances out. But Tim, I appreciate the call. Bernie in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernie.
Hi. I love your show, and it's a great honor to speak with you. I live in a city-owned apartment building, and like you, I'm very allergic to secondhand cigarette smoke. And when I first moved in here about a year ago, one Sunday, my apartment was just filled with secondhand cigarette smoke. And when I complained about it to the housing department of the city, they said that the legal department of the city said that a person living in that apartment building was allowed to smoke in his own apartment or her own apartment because that was their residence. But I said, if it's going through the ventilation system of the building, then it's not strictly a question of their being in a private surrounding. They're
right.
Now
did you,
in a public
did you end up winning or losing that argument?
Pardon me?
Did you end up winning or losing that argument?
Well, I haven't had any since. For a whole year, knock on wood, I haven't had any secondhand cigarette smoke.
Oh, so somebody probably just had a smoker over as a guest or something.
Well, either that or the housing department could have gone to the legal department and then,
and said,
you know,
something.
Whichever.
That's interesting. Bernie, I've got to move along. We've got a whole bunch of callers here and very little time. But thank you for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it. Connie in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Connie, got about a half a minute here before we got to take a break.
Okay, two things. When you're sitting in gridlock traffic with your window down and the cigarette smoke wafts through your window, how's that for you?
it's cigarette smoke and car exhaust.
No, but the point is, if we don't ban the cars, I mean, we go to another point, which is we make laws about the little things because we feel impotent about the big.
Well, but we actually have. We have banned a lot of the stuff coming out of the tailpipes of cars by requiring catalytic converters and requiring cleaner fuels.
Some of it, yeah.
Yeah, but I'd say an awful lot of it. I mean, you walk around the cities of you walk around Mexico City, for example, and look at what's coming out of tailpipes versus any city in America, and
well,
it is night and day.
Well, let's have a campus see which is worse, just for fun.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, the other thing is that car exhaust. You know, I think that there's a broad consensus that moving around in an automobile is something that facilitates some positive purpose, whether it's taking somebody to the doctor's office or going to work. Smoking is an addiction.
Yes.
And arguably a personal choice. And so I don't think that there's an equivalence there that allows us to debate the relative merits of
but
one or the
irony.
Other.
But some irony.
Yeah, but some irony. Absolutely kind. Thank you very much. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I fell into the burning roof fires. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire.
9.5 minutes before the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Gary in Syracuse, New York. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Yes. How you doing today?
I'm fine.
But
I will get better. What's up?
your arguments are actually quite mute. Because everybody who goes after cigarettes, the way they've been doing it, It's not the argument. It's the argument they want you to have, and it's what divides this country. Because it's not the tobacco per se, it is the chemicals within it. They're allowed to put in about 600 different chemicals.
Right.
And every study done on the so-called point about tobacco being this carcinogen, they always talk about cigarettes. Actually, they don't even use the word tobacco. They always say cigarettes.
Right.
1995, you'll find, and it's still there, last time I checked, 1995, U.S. government website stated that those who smoke tobacco, whether organic, pipe tobacco, cigars, et cetera, and they inhale, live longer than those who don't. It becomes contradictory to what you're being told about cigarettes.
I don't believe it.
It's on the government website.
I don't believe it anyway.
Well, okay, you do. The point
I mean, you can't convince me that inhaling hundreds of potent carcinogenic chemicals
and
destroying the structure of your lungs is going to cause you to live longer.
I'm not advocating the point of I'm saying that the real culprit here is chemicals, not the tobacco per se, because I smoke organic tobacco. If you want to outlaw organic tobacco, you also must outlaw any type of organic burning fires. You can't have a campfire, you can't have a barbecue grill, etc.
Well, you're absolutely right that when you burn any kind of cellulose, any kind of cellulotic product or cellulosic or however you say it, any plant material, you are going to produce, even pot, I mean, you are going to produce many of the exact same chemicals that are in tobacco. And you're also right that the cigarette companies are adding chemicals, and they've got hundreds of them to choose from to flavor and to keep cigarettes from going out as they naturally
right.
would if they didn't add burning agents and things like that are also probably toxic, or I have in many cases have been identified as toxic.
Well,
now, I get all that, but you know when you look at the issue
on the subject.
But when you, again, back to the issue of utilitarianism, I can argue that there's a good reason to have a car to get from place A to place B. I can argue that there's a good reason to have a wood stove to keep my house warm in order to be able to survive. But you can't make an argument that there's a good reason why you should smoke, other than that it feels
good. No, I'm not
giving
you a reason to smoke. I'm giving you ways to quit smoking as well as the real culprit.
Which is?
Okay. The real culprit being chemicals. Now, the statistical analysis that scientists have used to call cigarettes as this cancer-causing agent, there is one product that 100% of all lung cancer victims in this country have been exposed to.
Mashed potatoes.
And that's fragrant.
It's also, you will also find that 100% of all convicted mass murderers have eaten mashed potatoes at one time or another in our lives.
Yeah,
in their
I
lives.
Know
therefore,
that,
we should ban mashed potatoes.
Well, no, it's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about chemicals. Fragrances
okay.
are chemicals.
Right.
Pure chemicals. That's all it is. All studies
okay.
have shown all these chemicals cause all kinds of cancers. They
right.
Not
so,
be
so cut to the point. Cut to the chase, Gary. I got a whole board here full of calls. I want to get a few more in. We've only got 2 minutes left.
A quick explanation of how to quit smoking. One, you switch your brand of cigarette, your commercial cigarette, for a native brand cigarette. You get all the chemicals out of your cigarette. No additives.
Right.
After 6 months, your body memory kicks in. You won't be able to smoke a commercial cigarette. And
yeah, okay, great. So just, you know, go natural, go organic. It seems like a good place to start. Michael in Bronx, New York. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Tom. How you doing, guy? You know, I agree with you 100% when you mentioned about the double standard here between the condoms and the birth control. Now, here I am, a 40-year-old man, and I'm an equal rights advocate, and I believe that the young girls need the protection, as you had stated earlier. I mean, you know, what is it that the right wings cannot understand that you have several girls that are raped, molested, and then you have a result of
well, it appears that most of this was it appears that most of this was consensual sex, that they, you know, they had you know, all these pregnancies in the school between, you know, 14-year-old girls and boys. And to the argument on the other side is that a condom is not something that's going inside your body. A birth control pill is. A birth control pill is a hormone. It's going to modify your body in some way, and a modification that may, over the long term, actually increase the risk of things like heart attacks and cancer, and a condom won't.
Right.
So, you know, maybe they should be, instead of passing out birth control pills, they should be passing out diaphragms or something. I don't know.
But then the thing is, this goes right back to the right wingers. If it's not the racial bias, it's the gender bias. It's not the gender bias, it's the economic bias. And the reason why I brought up about the past history of young girls who are going about doing productive things, and yet they find themselves victims of sex crimes. You know, what is it that the right wings don't want to be reminded of 2006, when several right wing Congress people were got busted for their inappropriate conduct towards our minors?
Yeah, no. Well, hypocrisy has never been, you know, really a low value among, you know, just ask Larry Craig. Gene in San Francisco. Hey, Gene, got about a half a minute before we've got to wrap up this hour.
Oh, dear. Well, I can't cover it in that, but I wanted to address the acknowledgement of inalienable rights that Jefferson penned. And I think that's the hope and promise of the American dream. But your guest from the Ayn Rand Institute, he didn't want to seem to agree. Because instead of government existing to protect and promote these rights, he said government gives us those rights, and he's off base there.
Well, he absolutely is, and if he said that, I would suspect that he himself would say that he misspoke. I mean, you know, Jefferson's theory, although they phrased it in the context of occasionally of God-given rights, you know, even Jefferson wrote nature's God in the Constitution. Adams tried to change that to the Christian God, and Jefferson said no, it's more universal, more ubiquitous than that. It's in everything. I mean, I think Thomas Jefferson was an animist, and but you're right, this is a natural right, let's call it that.
And it's our hope and promise.
Indeed, well said. 57 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, strange goings on in the United States of America. By the way, Pete Seeger will be with us in a short while. Should be an interesting conversation today. I'm looking forward to that. Welcome back to the third hour of our program, 6 minutes past the hour. I guess the people who hate America are getting their comeuppance. Yeah, sure enough. You know, sometimes things are really and truly crazy. I mean, just really and truly crazy. No, maybe, but Glenn Beck is. Glenn Beck. Yeah, on his radio show, was it yesterday? I believe.
I think there is a handful of people who hate America. Unfortunately for them, a lot of them are losing their homes in a forest fire today.
Yeah, those people in California whose homes are being burned down, they just hate America. You tell them, Glenn. That takes courage to say something like that. I'll tell you that. Well, I will cease to characterize it beyond that. Holly Sklar pointing out over at CommonDreams.org yesterday, the billionaires up, America down. I mean, this is, again, this is the huge contrast between the New Deal era in the United States, 1940 to 1980, when we had a strong middle class, when between 25 and 35% of Americans had union jobs, which means that between 50 and 70% of all Americans had jobs that were the equivalent of a union job with good pay, pension, health benefits. One person could raise a family. The difference between the new and CEOs typically made 15 to 20 times what their workers do, what their most lowly paid workers do, rather than 300-400 times. When we did not see the emergence of dynasties or billionaires, instead we saw the emergence of democracy. Activists, citizens who were activists, people who cared about politics. That was what the New Deal brought us, and the conservatives did not like that. As Ronald Reagan pointed out when he did away with free public education, or nearly free, at the University of California system, you know, why should I pay my tax dollars to have somebody go and protest things that I disagree with? Well, because free public education at the college level is an investment in the future of your country, you bozo! Oh, I'm sorry, he just used to play bozo on television. In any case, oh no, it was Bonzo, and that was his monkey. Up until 2005. Now, this is under the Bush administration. Up until 2005, you could still be one of the 400 richest Americans and only be a multimillionaire. Now, you have to be a billionaire. Queen Elizabeth II. You know, the royal family, all that money they've been sitting on for, what, four centuries, five, six, seven, eight centuries, who knows how long. She would not qualify for the Forbes 400 Richest Americans. The net worth of Queen Elizabeth II is a mere paltry $600 million. Here in the United States, as Holly Sklar points out, we have a record 482 billionaires and record foreclosures. 47 million people without any health insurance, but we have 482 billionaires. During the last 2 decades, from Reaganomics until today, technically between 1983 and 2004, that's when these statistics were compiled, the average wealth of the top 1% of American households grew by 78%. The average wealth of the bottom 40% of American households didn't grow at all. Didn't fall by 10%, didn't fall by 20%, didn't fall by 30%, didn't fall by 40%. No, the money of the bottom 40% had to go somewhere. It had to go to the top 1%. While the top 1%'s income grew by 78%, the bottom 40% lost more than half, 59% of their wealth. In 2004, as Holly Sklar points out, one in six households. Today, one in six households has no net worth or a negative net worth. One out of three, a third of us, have either no net worth or a net worth of less than $10,000, including home equity. And that's before things got weird with the adjustable rate mortgages started flipping in and whatnot. Back when Reagan started out, the Forbes 400 had only 13 billionaires, and the highest paid CEO made $108 million. And the average full-time worker made $34,000 in today's dollars, adjusted for inflation. Well, the average worker still makes $34,000. But instead of only 13 billionaires, we now have 482 billionaires. And instead of the highest paid CEO in America making $108 million, the highest paid CEO made $647 million. Actually, the highest paid fund manager, not even a CEO, hauled in $1.7 billion last year. Just consider this. The 400 richest Americans, the Forbes 400, have $1.54 trillion in combined wealth. That's 11% of our gross domestic product. When Reagan came into office in 1982, the first full year of the Reagan administration, arguably the second year of the Reagan administration, 1982, the Forbes top 400 wealthiest Americans only owned 3% of our wealth. Today, they own 11%. And by the way, as Fortune magazine noted, the rich give away a smaller share of their income than the rest of us. Now, is this, as Holly Sklar notes, inequality has roared back to 1920s levels. Is this some kind of socialist rant, or is this some kind of class envy, or how dare people, you know, get rich? No. That's not my point, and that's not my issue. I'm all in favor of people starting businesses. I've done it myself. I'm all in favor of people making a lot of money. I've done that myself. Not billions, but, you know, I've done okay. My concern is the corrosive impact, and this is the concern that the founders and framers of the Constitution, the founders of this country had as well, by the way, which is why there were no millionaires or the equivalent of billionaires during the Revolutionary era, and they didn't start emerging until after the Civil War. My concern is that when wealth concentrates this intensely and this multi-generationally, as it has been ever since the 1880s with the rise of the robber barons and the change in state laws that allowed what was referred to in the 1880s and 1890s as charter mongering, where corporations no longer had to serve in the public interest as well as making money, but could simply make money instead of having any public interest, that it's corrosive to democracy. It's not a healthy thing for democracy. And then you combine that massive wealth with the power of government, as the libertarians like to refer to them, you know, men with guns. And what do you get? You get something close to what Mussolini and Franco accomplished in Europe in the 1920s and 30s. You get the merging of state and corporate enterprises, something called fascism or corporatism. For example, our liberal shadow alert for the day. Yes, he does. Think Progress reporting. The Pentagon is engaged in an aggressive U.S. grassroots campaign to drum up support for Bush's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in the guise of supporting the troops. And by the way, with your and my dollars, our tax dollars, a central front in this effort has been the, quote, non-political, end quote, ASY program. It's called America Supports You. One branch, by the way, of ASY is the Operation Straight Up, an evangelical entertainment troupe that actively proselytizes among active duty members of the U.S. military. The New York Times broke this story in May. The Pentagon IG, Inspector General, is looking into this. Large portion of the funds that were given to ASY, taxpayer funds, went to the PR firm of Susan Davis International. Susan Davis International hired to bolster domestic support for what? The organized slaughter of human beings, otherwise known as war. Stars and Stripes awarded a $499,000 purchase agreement in July 2006 to the PR firm to represent America Supports You. And they're now looking at this with extreme caution. Their staff think that they might have jeopardized their own legitimacy as an editorial independent newspaper. Yeah, the Bushies, they got them. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Well, Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, little boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. The great Pete Seeger on the line with us. Pete Seeger, welcome to the program.
Well, consider I'm 88. I'm no longer the great Pete Seeger. I'm very forgetful. However, I'll answer anything you want me to try.
Okay. Well, I just have to say, sir, I am absolutely honored to have you on the program. Back when you were with the Weavers in the 1950s, you were dragged before the House Un-American Committee during the McCarthy years. And instead of invoking the Fifth Amendment and refusing to testify, you invoked the First Amendment, your right to associate with whoever you want. You
know, that's right. I wanted to base my defense on a very basic American rights. You have a right to your own opinion and your own freedom of speech, or a lack of speech, if you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now there's a new film documentary out about you. It's called Pete Seeger, The Power of Song. With a number of interviews with you and, you know, historical stuff, and Roger Ebert gave it a great review. Studs Terkel blurbed it. Tell us about this.
Well, there was a guy I knew when he was a teenager who went into the business of making documentary movies. He made one telling about the shad fishing on the Hudson River where I live. And then he made one about the Weavers with a truly genius of a guy called Lee Hayes, who wrote the words of If I Had a Hammer and a whole batch of other songs. Mm-hmm. And a couple of years ago, he said, why don't I make a movie about your life? And I said, oh, I don't need the publicity. Just let me die in peace. But he went ahead and made it with my wife's help, as I was listed as one of the producers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad because it does have some nice singing, not my singing, but a whole show's people joining in singing together.
Yeah. And The Power of Song, the title of the movie, Pete Seeger, The Power of Song, your thoughts on the power of music to change culture. It certainly appears to me to have changed culture in many ways, many times over the centuries, frankly.
You know, Plato, the old Greek philosopher, is supposed to have said it's very dangerous to allow the wrong kind of music in the Republic.
Oh, really?
And the powers that be, as long as I knew, tried to keep songs all pleasant. Another love song. In the middle of the Depression, Bing Crosby was singing, wrap your troubles in dreams and dream your troubles away. That's how we were going to solve the Depression.
Yeah. Well, it was better than, you know, being afraid. I mean, FDR said the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, about the Depression, not about World War II. There is something to be said for not succumbing to terror.
And I like love songs as much as anybody else do. However, maybe the most important song I ever wrote in my life was called Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, the Big Fool Says to Push On. They tried to keep it off the air, but it got around anyway.
Now, why did they try to keep it off the air?
Because, in effect, it was implying that Johnson was a big fool for trying to keep us in the Vietnam War, and finally we had to get out. It was a big mistake, and I consider it one of the great victories of the American people to get out of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really was, and let us hope that we can get out of this equal mess in Iraq as quickly as possible.
Exactly, exactly.
Your thoughts on the modern music scene? We've seen some people, you know, take on the, you know, I guess the example of Natalie with the group out of Texas, and now I'm the one who's the Dixie Chicks. Thank you. Speaking out. What's the contemporary music scene? Do you have hope given what's going on?
I tell people there's a 50-50 chance of the human race going to be here in 100 years. Of course, I don't know. God only knows what the future is going to be. But he gave us brains, and if we'll use them, we'll start communicating with each other, even though we may disagree very strongly with each other. But if we don't communicate with each other, there's no hope. And I tell people, whether they're rich or poor, black or white or whatever, we got to find ways to communicate with each other. And if words fail, let's try music. Music can leap over language barriers and barriers of religion and politics. Mm-hmm. And who knows?
Yeah, music, it seems, I mean, you find, you know, indigenous people, music is a very rich tradition of passing along oral history. Music is not just the way we communicate, it's one of the ways that we transmit culture.
Often people find they, what really makes them feel like living is singing together. And what I do these days, since I don't have much voice of my own left, I get crowd singing, whether it's Turn, 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 or If I Had a Hammer, or Where Have All the Flowers Gone, or some old song like The Water Is Wide, I Cannot Cross Over. It's an old English love song, maybe, who knows, 500 years old for all I know. But it's so beautiful that people love to sing it together, just like we love to sing Amazing Grace together.
It's marvelous. The new movie, Pete Seeger, The Power of Song, it'll be scheduled for theatrical release soon. We'll get all the information on that. Pete Seeger, thank you so much, sir, for dropping by and sharing with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you. Stay well.
Great speaking with you.
Keep on.
Thank you, and you too. And you too. And keep spreading the message. It's,
okay.
It's an honor and a pleasure. 27 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
And who's going to be the one to say it was no good what we done? I dare a man to say I'm too young, for I'm going to try for the sun. We huddled in the derelict building, and when he thought I was asleep, he lay his poor coat round my shoulder and shivered there beside me in a heap.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Oh, a lot of strange stuff in the news here. Just a few quickies. Barack Obama has chosen a homophobe who crusades against the curse of homosexuality to go on a gospel concert tour with him. I'm guessing that probably Mr. Obama is getting a lot, or Senator Obama is getting a lot of pressure to pick somebody else to be singing his songs for him. So, you know, we'll see how that thing shakes out. Jay Rockefeller, taking a lot of money from the telecommunications companies, says, let's give them immunity. He wasn't taking so much money from them until just very recently, and now all of a sudden he's all in favor of immunity. A lot of people are raising their eyebrows on that. And I've been telling you all along, I've been saying this for years now, it's not so important to look at the U.S. attorneys who were fired by Karl Rove and George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and the rest of the Republicans. It's important to look at the ones who kept their jobs. What were they doing? For example, the prosecution of the governor down in Alabama. Well, here and now we have another one. Dick Thornburgh. This is the guy who was the attorney general under Ronald Reagan, the Republican attorney general under Ronald Reagan, testified today before the House Judiciary Committee saying that a Democratic coroner from Pennsylvania who was prosecuted by the Justice Department, by one of these U.S. attorneys. Why? He thinks the Justice Department had political aims in prosecuting a high-profile Democratic coroner from Pennsylvania. Quote, unquote. And then finally, the absolute bizarre story of the week. I mean, this is totally bizarre. Mitt Romney today says, and I quote, "Actually, just take a look at what Barack Obama said just yesterday. Barack Obama calling on radicals, jihadists of all different type, to come together in Iraq." So he starts out calling him Osama. He's apparently talking about Osama. And then he pauses and he calls him Barack Obama twice in response to this new audio tape that came out from Osama bin Laden. Kevin Madden, Romney spokesman, says he was referring to the audio tape of bin Laden and misspoke. Yeah. Expect to see a lot more of this. Expect to see a lot more of this as time goes on. Anthony in Seattle. Hey, Anthony, how'd the protest go yesterday?
Well, hey, Tom. I decided to take your advice, and I didn't take the sign that I had made attacking Hillary. And let me tell you what, all of these Republicans had apparently planned on descending on the Hillary fundraising event last night, and there were about 100 of them surrounding the hall, making a lot of noise, banners, signs. They had this well thought out, and there were only just a handful of progressives who showed up, and we kind of staked our turf on the other side of the street, and essentially with a huge banner advertising a anti-war march here in Seattle this Saturday, the 27th. But, you know, so essentially I took your advice and I took the moral high ground and I decided not to attack Hillary. But you know what? They were, it was just so crazy. And to tell you what, this Republican contingent was full of these Ron Paul supporters. Mm-hmm. And I equate them to the Lyndon LaRouche nuts that kind of, have you ever seen those people?
They're always, it's kind of a quasi-religious,
it's like
political
a cult.
Cult.
With them.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just wanted to let you know that, you know, I just Hillary's obviously, you know, I just don't want to, you know, like the Republicans have that edict in their platform, thou shalt not speak ill of your fellow Republicans.
Yeah, Ronald Reagan's 11th commandment.
I guess I'll have to follow that with the Democrats.
Well, to some extent, I think it's really important to call people to account when it comes to policy. But just to simply say, you know, progressives hate so-and-so, I don't think that helps us.
Can I just say one other thing, Tom?
Sure.
Are
you glad, by the way, you made the decision you did?
Thank you. I live up in Snohomish County, and our public utility district chairman or whatever, the president or CEO, it's a nonprofit, but he just got a $60,000 pay raise. And they said in the newspaper that the reason that they gave him such a pay raise was because they had to stay competitive with other utility entities.
Right.
And
right.
This
is the result of the end of the tax status that we had in the United States from the beginning of the New Deal in the late 1930s, mid-1930s,
so he was
up until Reagan.
He was making $250,000, and now he makes $310,000. And I just thought to myself, you know, $310,000 is a lot.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the tragedy. And this is again that because this is why I say we don't need to roll back the Bush tax cuts. We need to roll back the Reagan tax cuts and go back to some rationality where you've got, you know, a middle class that extends to an upper middle class that's that super managerial type, but not, you know, millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars, that equivalent. Real quickly, Anthony, was it the right choice to not take a sign that said progressives hate Hillary, but instead, you know, promote something positive at this march that you're doing this weekend?
At the end of it all, I felt good, you know, like when you give to the poor and the needy. I felt that kind of good inside because I was promoting an anti-war march this Saturday here in Seattle at Judkins Park at noon. I just didn't want to go down in the gutter with those. I mean, they were rabid, these Republicans that descended.
You would have just looked like another one of them.
Oh, my God. It was just so terribly. They were using curse words and calling her, you know, just really derogatory.
Yeah. I got it. And I got to move along, Anthony.
All right,
thank you very much for the call. And thanks for your service. And everybody show up at the park there on Saturday in Seattle, all of our listeners on Talk 1090. Linda, Daly City, California. Hey, Linda.
Hi, Tom. I had to take this opportunity to publicly thank Pete Seeger for being the person who has probably most influenced my notions of social justice over the years. I didn't realize it until much later than when I was a teenager, but I grew up in the Hudson River Valley, and I can remember prevailing upon my mother and my cousin prevailing on her mother to take us to a midnight concert in Woodstock, of all places. And after the concert, we tiptoed up to the stage door, and wouldn't you know that Mr. Seeger and his lovely wife, Toshi, invited us in, and we must have spent an hour talking to them. And they were kind enough not to encourage our singing careers.
That's so sweet. Yeah.
Encouraged us to get a good education. And, you know, but the funny thing is that here it is, you know, all these years later, and for the last 30 years I have been living in one of the original little boxes.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes we all go through those phases, Linda. But Linda, thank you for sharing the story with us. That's so sweet. Dan in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I was just thinking today, wouldn't it be a great idea to tie any additional funding for the Iraq War into redoing the S-CHIP bill and sending them together up to Bush? And if he wants
sure.
to veto it, absolutely, let him.
Yeah. Well, although I think that it's just, you know, the simple way to do this is just to say, sorry, George, you're not getting any more money. Or to go back to the appropriation that they wimped out on last time that said, okay, you want some money, here's some money, but by the way, you got to pull out by the spring. Even though, frankly, I think it would be the best thing for the Republicans if we started pulling out by the spring so that most of the troops were out in time for the election so it would no longer be an issue in the election. Even though it would be the best thing for the Republicans, it would also be this thing that would save the most lives, and therefore I'm in favor of it. But, you know, good point, Dan. Thank you, and very well made. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, got about a minute before a break here. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to remark about your comment about the district attorney in Western Pennsylvania. Her name's
the federal prosecutors, you mean?
Right. She's definitely a Bushy, and she prosecuted Cyril Wecht. You know who that is?
Yeah, the DNA lawyer guy.
Right, right.
Or expert guy.
Yes, he was involved in the Kennedy assassination. I mean, not killing him, but as far as the investigation is concerned.
Right.
And she also prosecuted Tommy Chong for his bongs. So, yeah, we know
that the U.S. attorneys who kept their jobs definitely have their priorities screwed on straight.
Yes,
they're going to
embarrassment. She really
yeah,
is.
And now this is one of the Bush appointees who kept
yes.
her job.
Yes.
Yeah. Mary Beth Buchanan, is that it?
Mm-hmm. Mary Beth
in
Buchanan.
In the Western District of Pennsylvania.
I think she might
Amazing.
Even serve part of like the Panhandle, West Virginia, and southeastern Ohio. But
yeah,
I'm not
those,
really sure.
those federal districts. Yeah. Bonnie,
mm-hmm.
thank you very much for sharing with us. Amazing. Well, this is the thing. I mean, somebody needs to be out there looking at the prosecutorial history of the people who kept their jobs, the U.S. attorneys who kept their jobs throughout the Bush administration, rather than just the ones who were fired. Because I'm telling you, that's where you're going to find the real dirt.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Please impeach me. Let me go. I can't serve you anymore. Oh, oh, oh. I've done all the damage I can do. There's only one more thing I can do for you. I'll be your sacrifice. Serve me up with mint jelly and a side of ham. And while you're at it, Cheney too. For once, I'll just tell him what to do.
Please impeach me, yes. The genius of Jim Turr. Welcome back. Ellen Radner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, how are you today?
Today is the day of conflicting stories. The president today at the National Defense University, talked about his national missile defense efforts and also talking about how important the program was and talked about how the fact that it was important to have missiles in foreign countries such as some of the NATO and European Union states. Well, it's interesting because he then also talked about the fact that the Russians, Russia didn't agree necessarily completely with him, but that Russia was willing to cooperate. Now, what's
is he on hallucinogens?
It, well, that's right, particularly because when you really think about this, today the Russian foreign minister, who I believe is in Japan today, said, basically, what is this about?
They think he's hallucinating, too. Here, I have a theory about this. I'd like to run it by you. Yesterday, Poland had their election. And for 2 years, Poland's been run by basically a right-wing bunch. And the liberals, the left-wingers, threw them out. And the right-wing bunch that has been running Poland, and you know, democratic elections, I don't remember the names of the parties, I'm sorry, but the right-wing party has aligned itself with Bush and has been gung-ho to put Bush's missiles in Poland along with Czechoslovakia. I am speculating, and I haven't seen much about this in the press, that the left-wing group that is replacing them is not going to be so enthusiastic to put Bush's missiles in Poland, and that's why all of a sudden in the last 24 hours, Bush and his buddies are talking about, well, maybe we can wait a little while before we put these missiles in Poland, as if they can kind of take credit for doing something that basically the Poles are going to say to them, nah, we're not going to play that game anymore, and that's going to cause Putin to calm down. What do you think?
Well, especially, well, I bet that sounds like a pretty on-target analysis, speaking of missiles, essentially yesterday Secretary Gates said that the U.S. may delay activization, as you know, about this. So,
right, that's my point.
But
I think he said that because of the regime change.
He gives a speech today. The ballistic missile threat to America has been growing for decades. And now he's saying, you know, the number of countries has grown to 27. It includes hostile regimes with ties to terrorists. I mean, it was really one of these speeches that will go down in history as being this completely, you know, Cold War.
This is worse than the 16 words about uranium. I mean, how many countries have a ballistic missile that actually has the throw capacity to reach the United States? There's the Soviet Union. There are our allies in Europe. And that's it, isn't it? I mean, China says that they're developing one.
That maybe the Chinese missile could reach California or the very tip of Alaska or something like that. It certainly can probably reach Guam, which is the United States territory.
Right, or Hawaii.
But that's right.
But that's it.
Right. I mean, you're right.
That's not 23 nations.
But what a way to terrify everybody right before the New Hampshire and Iowa primary.
Oh, man. This is so disappointing.
So this much is... of this, particularly the 46 billion dollars that's wanted in the supplemental. Reid and Nancy Pelosi want to do it after Christmas. Bush is saying, "Oh no, it's got to be done before Christmas." Well, the money is there.
Yeah. Well, not only that, this time they released the Osama tape only 25 minutes after they asked for the money. I mean, it's getting pretty conspicuous here.
Yeah, I mean,
typically they wait a day, you know.
You just have to wonder about the PR White House, and as I said, I have a friend of mine who's really sort of in charge of that in the White House, and I'll tell you, this guy I wrote about in my book. This guy is probably one of the brightest PR guys, because it doesn't matter that you and I make the connections. What matters is with Joe and Sally watching their TV in Middle America, who are going to vote in these primaries. That's what a lot of this is about.
Right. And today we had Mitt Romney referring to Osama bin Laden and the audio tape that he just released and calling him. He starts out saying Osama, and then he corrects himself and calls him Barack Obama twice. Is this the beginning of a new strategy on the part of the Republicans?
I don't know if it's a new strategy, because you really haven't heard the other front. I mean, you haven't heard Giuliani or anybody saying that. And I don't think Giuliani would ever lower himself to do that. But I think it means that he is desperate. Anybody who does that is desperate.
Romney.
Yeah. Desperado.
Yeah, in fact, my understanding is if he had not funded his own campaign with money out of his own pocket, he would be financially worse off than John McCain.
Yeah, and Ron Paul's better than John McCain, absolutely.
Right, right. So he'd be below.
The
top two Republicans would be Ron Paul and Rudy Giuliani.
There was a censure to a vote to censure Stark. It failed 196 to 173. He then apologized afterwards. Apparently, somebody called his office and asked him about apologizing before, and he said he was told not to. Interesting.
Yeah, well, that is interesting, and it's interesting that the censure vote failed. I actually commend Congressman Stark. I don't think it was the most elegant thing or the most elegant timing, but, you know, good on him. So, anyhow, Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
We'll talk with you shortly offline. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, Robert Peters, should morality and media be deciding what's porn and what's not? And Joseph Mitten Annan is here about the Brotherhood of the Disappearing Pants, a field guide to conservative sex scandals. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.